I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Graham McQueen. Graham is founding director of the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University. He's dedicated to peace. He's also focused heavily on 9/11 studies. He lectures and writes about them. He's an important guest. I'm delighted to have him on the program. Graham, welcome back.
Thank you, Stephen. It's wonderful to be here.
It's good to have you on the program, Graham. There's so much we can talk about. I suggested a couple of topics. I'm very interested in the ones that you may want to discuss. I mentioned Obama's State of the Union address and his new retirement scheme.
Well, Stephen, let me just comment. I think we should start with Obama's speech. You'll know 100 times more about the retirement scheme than I do. I mean, as a Canadian, you know, I just don't know what's going on there. And I read your article on that with great interest. So I do think you should talk about it. There are other parts of the State of the Union address, though, that I'd be happy to talk about. So I think that's a good way to get going. And then maybe after that, we can take what really is the theme of deception is at the center of both of your recent pieces about Obama. And I would like us to back up and look at the theme of deception in U.S. Military history as a theme, maybe once we finish with the State of the Union address.
Oh, I agree. I agree exactly. Deception defines America. It defines Obama. I mean, you can't operate a government the way America operates and not absolutely have it be duplicitous from A to Z. And that certainly is the case during the Bush years, during the Obama years. I think going back about as far as my memory takes me, I was too young to remember Franklin Roosevelt.
We can talk about him, too.
I was old enough to remember when he died, 1945, I believe. I think April 1945. Okay. I was about 10 years old, so I remember that. But during the heart of his administration, I was very, very young, so sure. I don't really remember much of whatever went on. And no television in those days.
Right. Yeah, I can remember you and I reminiscing about ancient TV sets once before.
Oh, yes. How well I remember them. We didn't have a TV in my household till I think I was a sophomore in high school, and the hours were abbreviated compared to now. I think maybe coming on maybe 7 in the morning and signing off at 10 or 11 o'clock at night. Yeah. And before the programming began, the channels, we only had 3 of them, as I recall. They would put up a test pattern. I think I mentioned this.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was so odd that I could flip a switch on a box and have a picture appear on it and a test pattern, and I would sit there for a few minutes and just watch the test pattern.
Yeah. I remember watching the test pattern. I know. So that kind of dates us. You've got a few years on me, Stephen, though. So your stories about the ancient past are better than mine, I have to admit.
Well, I remember World War II very well because the only thing my dad wanted to listen to when he came home from work was to turn on the radio and get the news, and it was all about the war. And I can remember thinking, I can hardly wait for this war to be over, so there'd be something else in the news besides war talk.
Oh, good for you. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of young boys were excited about the war. I know, I remember my mother telling me, this is one more ancient, a little bit more reminiscence, and then we should get into the State of the Union address. But I was always fascinated with this. My mother said that when she was a girl, they had this big, big radio, you know, sitting in the living room, obviously no TV. And the news came on one day that indeed Canada was at war. This was at the beginning of the Second World War because, you know, Canada got involved immediately, whereas the U.S. Stayed out of it for a couple of years. And her father, which is to say my grandfather, she said, sat there in the living room and began to weep. So here's a man who fought in the trenches in World War One. His war helmet, which I saw as a kid, just full of bullet holes. And And he knew that his son was going to end up in the Second World War doing this all over again. And hopefully not just his son, but all these young men and all these countries that were going to be devastated. And I think of this very quiet, reserved man who always refused to talk about what he went through in the World War One. I picture him sitting in front of that radio and weeping for a whole generation that's going to be put through this meat grinder again. And my mother was really struck by it because she said as a girl, she was kind of excited when she heard that there was going to be war. Oh, wow. And then to her shock, you know, there's her father who she never, ever saw weeping. And so, it was a moment for her that she never forgot. And I just wanted to pass on that moment because I think it's a moment of wisdom, really.
Well, I must say, Graeme, my father was in World War One in France.
Yeah.
I don't know much about what he did because he never wanted to talk about it.
Yeah.
And I never pressed him.
Yeah.
So I just let it pass.
Yeah.
And the only souvenir he brought back, he had a pistol that he brought back. It never was loaded. It sat in an unlocked desk drawer.
Yeah.
And I remember looking at it a few times and holding it a few times. And that was the only moments in my life I ever held a pistol in my hand.
Yeah.
And the only time I ever had a weapon in my hand was when I was in the Army in the 1950s.
Right.
Going through training,
yeah.
And I had to fire a rifle, and I had to fire a machine gun, and I didn't want anything to do with any of that. But you know, that's part of the training.
Right.
And I never even saw a weapon up close and personal, except on a cop in a holster as he might pass on the street.
Yeah.
And I never saw a cop with a gun drawn, and I certainly hope I never will.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting perspective. A number of things there that we could talk about, but why don't you take us back to the State of the Union?
Well, the State of the Union, it's generally a long address, and Obama was no different. I think he spoke for about 45 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and it was literally duplicity from A to Z, from the opening comments right through to the end. And I began in my article quoting from his first State of the Union address when he promised, quote, to get our economy growing again, save as many jobs as possible, and help Americans who had become unemployed. And he called jobs creation, quote, his number one focus. Well, in his first 2 years in office through the end of 2010, he created a sum total of zero jobs.
Yeah.
One more promise at the beginning of my article, Graeme.
Yeah.
He promised help for, quote, 8 million Americans paying for college.
Mm-hmm.
And my comment was, graduates are more indebted than ever. Outstanding debt tops $1 trillion. It's well over $1 trillion. It's second only to U.S. mortgage debt. It passes credit card debt. And for millions of young Americans, new graduates into their working lives, it represents many years of debt bondage. And for too many, it literally reflects lifetime debt. I wrote twice about the U.S. student loan racket separately, Graeme. It's in both of my books, How Wall Street Fleeces America and Banker Occupation, a chapter in each of them on it. It really is a racket because there's no way these kids or adults, as they get older, can default on their debt. They're always beholden to that debt, and if they default on it, they can have their wages garnished. If they go to retirement and are still in default, they can have their Social Security benefits taken away from them. That's how serious this debt is. It's the only debt that people incur in America that's anything like this. And I must say, Obama signed on to making it as onerous as it is.
Well, I appreciate your making that clear to me because I didn't understand that it was that different from the other forms of debt. So it's quite literally, or I shouldn't use the term literally, it's genuinely debt bondage, which is how you refer to it in your article. And it's similar to the debt bondage that poor countries have fallen into all over the world.
About the only way to escape would be to take everything you own and leave the country.
Yeah.
that, I don't know if they can come get you in another country, especially if they don't know where you are, but they probably could find you. But that's the only escape from this. It's literally a dead ball and chain around you until you pay it off. And back, you know, Graeme, when we went to school, certainly when I went to school in the 1950s, education was so cheap, they practically gave it away.
Yeah.
1952. $600 tuition. That was about the max you would pay anywhere in the country. And if you went to a state school, it was free.
Yeah. Well, it was similar in Canada. When I first went to university, I remember it was $800 for annual tuition, which, you know, I had to raise through my summer job and all that, but it wasn't a big deal. And, you know, then you got to live in residence, and it was pretty cheap. And I was staggered when I saw, well, of course, prices of all these things have gone up in Canada, too, but not as much as in the U.S. If you want to go to a non-state university in the U.S., I was quite staggered when I gave a couple of guest talks, and people told me what the young people were expected to spend per year, my God. So this is an issue that I haven't looked into closely, and I'm grateful for you to for pointing that out. The more general theme of duplicitous speeches by heads of state is kind of interesting to me. And of course, these occasions, I mean, we all know this is public ritual, you know. The State of the Union address, it's a public ritual. People tend to want to get up and sit down and applaud and do all the ritual genuflecting, and the president is an actor, and a bunch of people write things for him, and he says them with a certain flourish. How he says them is important. I assume there's a great deal of rehearsal and a lot of stage direction and advice, and how he cuts his hair and how he what suit he wears. So this is all public ritual. It can be analyzed as ritual. And people do analyze it that way. They analyze it for dramatic gesture. They analyze the words that are used and how often they occur, all this stuff we know. So it would be naive of us to expect he's going to go up and just say, well, you know, this is what's happening in America. But we have a couple of things we can look at. One is what you've looked at, which is how much of this is just straight lie and deception. Because even if it is public ritual, that doesn't mean it has to be all lie and deception. And then the other question is, what kind of a symbolic order is he creating through his gestures and his speech? In other words, what picture of the world is he creating? What's good? Is war good or is war bad? Is peace good or is peace bad? That kind of thing. And it would be nice if we could talk about both of those. When I read your article, I found it inspiring, actually. I always find it inspiring when people inside a country are able to dissent from their own government and their own elites. And although your article is in prose, obviously, it reminded me a little bit, I don't know if you remember Robert Bly's poem, The Teeth Mother Naked at Last?
No, I don't.
He wrote it during the Vietnam War. It's a very fine poem, in my opinion. And I'm not going to blab on about the poem too much, but I thought, if you didn't mind, I'd read about half a page of it.
Oh, absolutely. Please do it, Graham.
Okay, so here's the context. Bly's poem is a poem of agony by an American who sees that his government is carrying out horrendous crimes in Vietnam. And not only that, but that every time the president stands up to justify it, he lies. And he lies and he lies and he lies. So Bly has written it from that kind of position of agony and outrage and what you might call really, really dark humor. So here's about half a page. The chief executive enters. The press conference begins. First, the president lies about the date the Appalachian Mountains rose. Then he lies about the population of Chicago. Then about the weight of the adult eagle. Next, about the acreage of the Everglades. He lies about the number of fish taken every year in the Arctic. He has private information about which city is the capital of Wyoming. He lies about the birthplace of Attila the Hun. He lies about the composition of the amniotic fluid. He insists that Luther was never a German and only the Protestants sold indulgences. And the Attorney General lies about the time the sun sets. I just thought I wanted to read that because it reminded me that we aren't the first people to go through this kind of disgust when we hear a litany of lies. That the Vietnam War was promoted through one lie after another, and it would be good at some point if we could get to that. I think I'll lead us to that if we have time. And that we now, in our era, or I should say in the most recent period, under Bush especially, but now under Obama, have a new set of lives. And so the citizen, you know, the member of civil society, especially in the U.S., and that's you, that's not me, I'm looking in from the outside. Of course, we in Canada have our own lying prime minister and our own set of myths. But, you know, how do we react to that? What do we do? And what do we do when we listen to a State of the Union address that has so many lies and that's building myth, public myth? And I wanted to raise that as a question. So I have a few things to say about the symbolic order that I think he's building in that speech. But you know more about the actual lies, the content of the lies, the difference between what he's saying and what is the reality in the United States right now than I do. So what do you think are some of the main lies that are there?
Well, Graeme, I must say that I was on to Obama before he ever became president, because I went back and I looked at his Senate voting record and I wrote about it. In fact, I have a new article that I'll put out tomorrow, and I mention a couple of things that he supported related to the topic that I addressed in my article on the Keystone XL pipeline, a terribly environmentally contaminating project if it goes ahead. And it looks like Obama will rubber stamp its approval and have it built. And once they start transporting the Canadian tar sands dirty oil through it, we can expect all kinds of environmental contamination, especially because of the company that's building it, TransCanada. It has a horrific record of pipeline explosions and damages and cutting corners and so on. And so we know there's trouble coming. But in his Senate voting record, he was as much Republican or even more so than many Republicans in Congress. So it was very easy to know what he would be as president. And deception defines him as well. He literally, time and again, says one thing and does another. You simply can't believe anything that he says. I think growing numbers of people, Graeme, are catching on to him. But still not enough. His approval rating, it hit a low of 38%, I think, in the past couple of months. And I wrote about an approval rating maybe several weeks ago that was 39%. And, of course, depending on the poll you look at, it can vary a little bit. I think it's hovering around 40%, which is way down from where it was a year or two ago or earlier in his presidency. And it's jumped up and down, of course, the way it always would. But why anybody supports this man, except the people benefiting from his policies, I simply don't know. He's caused so much harm to so many people, literally, in my opinion, more so than any other president in America's history. Literally millions and millions of people so grievously harmed in America alone, let alone around the world. If you took a poll on people in the Middle East and other countries that are affected by U.S. policy, they'd probably get a 10% approval rating.
Right, sure.
But in America, 40%? I want to see it drop to 30, 25. Then I'll know the American people have really caught on to him, but I haven't seen it yet.
No. You said you don't know why people support him, and of course, I don't pretend to know the answer to that either, but I think part of it, if I can base it on friends of mine, because, you know, Obama wasn't just popular in the U.S. Polls taken in Canada during the presidential elections showed that Obama was very popular in Canada compared to his competitors, and George Bush was despised in Canada, as he was throughout much of the world, and that a lot of people in the world, not just Canada, thought, well, what an interesting thing, you know, here's a guy who gets up and talks about equality and justice and women's rights and even peace. We know he talks about that from time to time, racial equality, and people wanted to believe the best. Now, I don't want to say that I was taken in, because I wasn't. That wouldn't be fair. But lots of people, including a lot of friends of mine, were. And so when you say, why do people believe it? I think there's a powerful desire to hope, and I think that it gets to this issue that I talked about a moment ago, the symbolic order. It sounds a little abstract, but all I mean is he paints a certain picture of the world in his speech, and I don't think it is exactly the same as the picture that George W. Painted in his State of the Union addresses. And I think we have to understand the difference between them. Before I get to that, though, I want to go back to, this is an old debate that I've been involved in for decades, and I still don't really have a very good position on it worked out. I remember back when Jimmy Carter came into power, and we were having all these debates, because he talked about human rights a lot, and you know, the U.S. had to have an ideal and principle-driven foreign policy and so on. So there was one faction of the groups that I belonged to. I was already in the anti-war movement and various other movements, that said, you know, this guy is in a way even more dangerous, his administration, because, of course, fundamental U.S. policy has not changed. It's certainly not based on human rights. And he's taking in a lot of people. He's drawing on people's basic goodness, their desire to believe good in the world. But he's not following through, and this is more dangerous because social movements of opposition tend to collapse in these moments. You can have an obvious anti-war movement, a huge one, against Ronald Reagan. I mean, you know, even I marched in New York City with 1 million people against Ronald Reagan's policies. 1 million people in New York City. But Carter, on the other hand, what do you do? It confuses people. They don't know. So these people were arguing, you know, this guy's more dangerous. His administration is more dangerous. So that's one position, and I listen to it. I take that very seriously. On the other hand, I remember talking to an activist from El Salvador, and I don't remember whether he was a labor activist or human rights activist, or I just don't remember. But I remember asking, you know, does this matter, you know, to you when Carter comes in and says human rights is now going to be a guiding principle of our foreign policy? And he said, yes, it does matter. He said the moment he said that, it created a degree of political opening for us, a little bit less danger when we organized. We could use it, we could draw upon it, we could make much of it, and we could take that opportunity to organize better and to have a more effective social movement. So there's the dilemma. I was caught in it back then. I didn't have a clear answer, and I still don't now, because on the one hand, I could see that our own social movements of dissent and disagreement seem to be weaker when we have, let's say, an Obama who also pretends to believe all these great ideals. You know, and I think it's true. I think the anti-war movement is in complete disarray in North America. It's almost non-existent in some ways. And that's not just the anti-war movement. It's various social movements. So they get confused, they get weakened, they get co-opted. On the other hand, right, on the other hand, who am I? At the time, a university professor, I'm retired now, but at the time, a university professor sitting comfortably in Canada, what right do I have to say Jimmy Carter and his rhetoric are even more dangerous than Reagan when the people who are trying to build social movements for justice in these terrible regions, their kids are being kidnapped and tortured and murdered, and they're saying it does help. This language, this rhetoric, this different symbolic world that Carter is painting concretely helps us. And so that was my dilemma, and in a way it still is, because when I look at the Obama speech, I mean, this is why I really appreciate what you've done. You know the on-the-ground situation better than I do, and you can say lie, 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 and point it all out, and that's obviously important. It's huge, though. It's crucial, right? But on the other hand, I've been recently studying yet again, God knows how many times I've read it, the document by the Project for a New American Century, you know, dated 2000, Rebuilding America's Defenses. Okay, so this is hardcore kind of neocon material. This is done by the people who laid the foundation for the false flag, 9/11, anthrax, fraudulent global war on terror. This is who that's coming from. And the world that they evoke, the picture of the world they evoke, is significantly different from the one Obama painted. And I'm sure they despise him, just like their whole document is full of their contempt, their hatred of Clinton, which to you and I may seem bizarre. I mean, Clinton's not, you know, our ideal, and yet they loathe him. and they loathed what he stood for. They loathed the fact that under Clinton, the U.S. military spending actually started to go down. Now, it's true that by the end of his presidency, it leveled out and started to go up again. But nonetheless, he presided over this very significant decline in U.S. military spending, and they hate that, right? And they're determined to reverse it, which they do, either directly or indirectly through all these false flag attacks and deception and everything. They massively reverse it, and it goes way the hell up, okay? You with me here?
Yes, yes.
So now we have Obama, and he gives a speech, and so I've read it really carefully and looked at, you know, there's all these professors of English who study all the use of words and everything. Anybody with a computer nowadays can do this. And we see that he has drawn a different picture than the Bush people. He's pretty much dropped terrorism. It comes up a few times, but the number of times it's used in his speech is way down from George Bush. He's presenting a different picture for people. He's saying, I don't want America on a permanent war footing. I don't want these commitments to go on any longer than necessary overseas in Iraq and blah, blah, blah. He touches on Syria very lightly, in which he hilariously claims credit for a diplomatic solution. Nonetheless, here's what he's doing. He's using the word diplomacy again and again. And he's saying this is the way to go. And his compromise with the political right is massive. I mean, he says it's diplomacy backed by force. And he doesn't mention the word international law a single time because it's clear that he's completely given in on that one. He's completely not interested in international law, even though he's a former professor of law. But so I'm trying to say, is it significantly different or not? I think it is. I mean, I think the guys who wrote Rebuilding America's Defenses are sneering and sputtering when they hear that State of the Union address. And it's even possible that saying those kinds of things, which to you and me are they don't go nearly far enough in the direction of justice and peace. But nonetheless, it's possible that that will get them in trouble. I mean, you remember presumably what Rumsfeld said when Obama said, well, you know, I want to bomb Syria, but I'm going to take it to Congress. Rumsfeld, oh, give me a break, you wimp. You don't go to Congress. And because they did go to Congress, it didn't happen, okay? Now, it still may happen, of course, and not out of the woods. Sarin gas thing is a fraud, as you and I know. So it's not like I'm praising Obama or saying he's this great progressive or anything. But the difference is substantial.
Graeme, can I add one thing?
Yeah.
I have two articles I'll put out tomorrow. One is on the Keystone XL pipeline.
Right.
And the other one is titled, Obama Planning War on Syria?
Right. Right.
And that's the theme of my article.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I don't sit in on their policy meetings,
right,
but I have very strong feelings that that's exactly what is being planned with another false flag, just the way the false flag nearly launched a war last summer,
yeah,
after the so-called chemical attack in a suburb of Damascus,
right,
that the insurgents committed and the Assad government was falsely blamed.
Right.
And the reason Obama didn't attack Syria is because the public opposition in letters and emails and so on to Congress was overwhelmingly anti-war.
Yeah, which is really exciting.
Yeah,
but what I'm saying, Stephen, is that I don't disagree with you. I think that there are, I mean, for one thing, I don't pretend to know anything about what goes on in Obama's head. The man is a complete enigma to me. I don't know if he even has any ideas. But so when I talk about Obama, I really mean the people behind him.
Yes.
And it seems to me that, I mean, obviously he represents elite interests. So the question, in a way, that I'm posing is there a consensus among U.S. elites, or are there significant differences? But what I'm trying to say is, well, there's a consensus on some issues, but there are still significant differences. This is my proposal. So there's a consensus, for example, that the U.S. should not follow international law and, in fact, should sabotage it. I think that's clear. And Obama's part of that. But there's still a difference between immediately bombing and going through the process of diplomacy, or even if it's fake diplomacy. I mean, this is a kind of Colin Powell position where you at least pretend that you want diplomacy and you try and get the support of the rest of the UN. I still think that there are differences in U.S. elites on this. 9/11 itself, for example, I doubt very much if all of U.S. elites, or whatever you want to call them, the ruling class, if they all somehow decided, let's do 9/11. I don't think they all supported that. I think that was, you know, a strategy of a particular faction of U.S. elites. And I think we need, you and I, people like us, need, on the one hand, to do the kind of rigorous, stringent critique of Obama that you did in your paper, because nobody else is going to do it, so we have to do it. But at the same time, I'm saying let's not ignore real differences when they exist. I'm saying the Project for New American Century people hated Clinton, and they hated what that administration represented. And I think they hate Obama, even though you and I might find that hilarious. And so that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to open up that discussion.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. I mean, this is the politics of America, Graeme.
Yeah.
I think it's the idea that Republicans are especially vicious and we need to take a break.
Yeah.
But when a Democrat is in the White House, the only thing the Republicans want is to get back in the White House. So
yeah.
Even though a president like Clinton and Obama gives the elite interests of America virtually everything they want.
Yeah.
Republicans still want to get back in the White House, so they beat up on him. Let's take a short break,
okay,
and then we'll come back and pick right up on this.
Yep.
Welcome back. Talking with Graeme McQueen. Graeme, if you held your thought as we went to break, I'll let you pick up where you left off.
Oh, okay, Stephen. Well, I don't know how interested your listeners are in this, so I'm not gonna go on an extended rant. But I just wanted to raise it as an issue because I went through one of the analyses of the words that Obama used in his speech. It's published on, I think it's Washington Post website. And again, as I said, we don't really have to depend upon these studies anymore. Anybody with a computer can download the speech and do word searches, right? So I thought to myself, well, you know, the guy got his Juris Doctor from Harvard Law School, and he taught at Chicago Law School, University of Chicago Law School. He's a law guy, right? So how many times?
Constitutional law, Graeme.
That's right. But I thought to myself, I wonder how many times the concept of international law, which is actually very important to me, okay? And we could talk about that if you want. But
I quote from it all the time.
Okay. Well, you know, so how many times has it come up in the speech? And the answer is it doesn't.
Oh, it doesn't come up at all.
Neither is the UN mentioned. It's quite remarkable to people in some parts of the world.
Can I mention one thing overall about his speech?
Yeah.
He spent very little time about foreign policy and devoted most of the speech to what's going on in the U.S.
Yes.
And the reason is because so many people in America are suffering from what I call a protracted mainstream depression. That's exactly what it is, because the official unemployment rate, I believe, is 7.3%. It's
right.
A fake number. The real unemployment rate is 23.3%. 23.3%.
Yeah, it's staggering.
And
it really is.
That's based on the way unemployment was calculated 30 years ago.
Yeah.
But the model has been completely changed and corrupted, and the numbers that come out now are fake. And it's the same with the GDP number, the same with the inflation number. You can take one number after another that comes out of Washington, the Commerce Department, the Labor Department. They're fake numbers. They're manipulated to make things look better than they are, but they just don't hold water.
Yeah, so, I mean, again, very valuable for you to point that out in your article. But now this brings us back to that dilemma that I tried to sketch earlier and that I find myself still caught in, And that is, you could put it this way, is the Obama administration with its picture of the world. And let's admit, okay, this picture is largely mythical, but nonetheless, it gets a picture. And it's got diplomacy, and it says time to bring the troops home and all that. And then we've got the George Bush one, which says war is good, aggression is good, and more troops, unending war is what we want, permanent war footing is going to be necessary for global war on terror. They're different. It seems to me they are different pictures. And my question is the fact that this picture has changed a good thing or a bad thing? You know, this goes back to the Carter-Reagan discussion. It can be called a bad thing, and the argument is that it's more deceptive, and that social movements in our own, you know, countries tend to be to fall on hard times when they buy into, they're not able to see through this deception. And the argument on the other side is, well, you know, this may give people in other parts of the world a little relief. Like if I were living in Syria right now, I might say, well, I don't like Obama and he's a liar and everything, but I'm glad that my country isn't being bombed, which it would be by now if Bush was president. And they might say to us, look, Stephen, and look, Graham, this matters to us. We're alive. Okay? So that's the dilemma. And if you have anything to add about how we sort our way through that, I'd be interested, because I feel still a bit stuck on it.
Well, as far as Obama and his war policy, Graham,
yeah,
he literally has been at war every day in his administration from day one to this very moment, and he will complete 8 years in office. I assume he'll complete them.
Right.
And every day, America will be at war. Not one war, multiple wars, direct ones, proxy ones. And in my article, I did something different in the article I'll put out tomorrow,
yeah,
on whether he's planning the war in Syria,
right,
that he planned to wage last summer, around September, I believe.
Right.
Could have been August, but let's say September.
Well, yeah.
And the war wasn't canceled. In my opinion, it was just postponed.
Right.
And we have these peace talks going on.
Yeah, yeah.
They began with a lot of bickering. On January 22nd, there was a meeting in Montreux, Switzerland, participated in by 40 countries. The only legitimate ones, Syria was there, and
yeah,
the only legitimate ones presenting responsible comments were China and Russia.
Right.
There may have been a couple of others, but basically the deck was stacked with anti-Syrian governments,
yeah,
represented by their people, and they just beat up on Assad, one country after another,
yeah,
for the whole day, or maybe,
yeah,
into the second day. And the only speech, I discussed it at great length, Syria's foreign minister, he gave a marvelous speech. I mean, it was very tough reading, because everything he said was true about the horrors that the Syrian people have been going through for almost,
yeah,
3 years now.
Yeah.
And I quoted him at length, but it was an important speech. And the Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, a U.S. imperial tool, he criticized the foreign minister, Walid al-Molam. He criticized him for taking,
yeah,
so long, because the other countries only had 7 or 10 minutes or so.
Yeah.
Well, he was the only one representing his country's interests against dozens of others. Give,
yeah,
the guy a break. And he,
no,
probably went on for 45 minutes or so. They,
yeah,
should have given him 2 hours if he wanted,
yeah,
it.
Sure.
I mean, there was so much to talk about, and the suffering of the Syrian people is so horrendous,
yeah,
and it's because it's Obama's war. The war was planned before Obama came into office, but he didn't have to wage it, but he did. And in the article that I'm writing tomorrow on whether he plans that war now, I did something I never did. I started off quoting what he said in October 2007 as a candidate, and he said, quote, I will promise you this, that if we have not gotten our troops out by the time I am president, he was talking about Afghanistan.
Right.
If I have not gotten by the time I am president, it's the first thing I will do.
Right.
I will get our troops home. We will bring an end to this war. You can take that to the bank, quote,
yeah,
unquote.
Yeah.
Well, the troops are still there. The war is still raging. He promised to get them out by... I remember once in end of 2011,
yeah,
maybe 2012. Now it's the end of 2014.
Yeah.
Even his planned withdrawal isn't a planned withdrawal. It's a drawdown. It's,
yeah,
not a withdrawal.
Yeah.
I mean, they're bickering with the Afghan government, you know, a stooge government appointed by the Obama by the Bush administration,
I know,
the Karzai government.
Yeah, I know.
no legitimacy.
But the thing is, Stephen, this is all great stuff, but you're still saying the man is a liar, and I agree. But I'm not disagreeing with that at all, and I agree with you that Syria has been at war because the U.S. has backed that war and because it has planned that for a long time. I agree with all that.
Green, one more quick comment. I don't want to go through all this because I include an awful lot in following up on that quote. I mean, he is a liar, and I prove it because my comments then went on to say, and he'll close Guantanamo, and he'll hold Bush administration war criminals accountable, and he'll end lawless military commissions trials, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
I went through about two dozen of these things.
Yeah.
And every one of them a lie.
Yeah.
Every one a promise, and every one a promise broken.
Yeah. Well, I'm not disagreeing with any of that. Okay, I'm absolutely with you. It's systematic deception. Again, I don't know what Obama as an individual thinks about anything. So I assume when you talk about Obama, you mean a group of people.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
he's the front guy.
Yeah, he's the front guy. He's Chris Hedges calls him a brand. You know, as an advertising, he's a brand.
Oh, it's a good way to describe
it. Yeah. So I guess part of what I'm asking, though, is it's a different question. It's really whether there's any advantage at all for the world in having this brand over the Bush brand. And I'm saying there's arguments for both sides. It's not a matter of, I'm not saying Obama is a progressive guy and a peace guy and all that. He should have given back his Nobel Peace Prize years ago. But anyway, I don't want to hammer this on too long, but it seems to me it is still an interesting question.
Oh, it really is. Should we talk a little bit about his MyRA proposal?
Yeah, although that's going to be you, because I don't, you know, what you wrote about that was interesting, but the whole issue is new to me.
Well, I'll be very brief. I don't want to dwell on it in detail. There are so many things to talk about Obama. His State of the Union address, it covered so much about what's going on domestically and a little bit about what's going on abroad. But, of course, he left out the stuff that people really need to know, and that's the stuff that I write about. And I was able to comment on so much about what he said in his State of the Union address, Graham, because I've written separate articles on this stuff for the past 5 years.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I went back and I reviewed some of the things I wrote. I could talk about all the issues that he addressed, and I probably wrote an article about just about every one of them. Well, here this new retirement proposal, well, it's phony. It's an absolute phony scheme.
Yeah.
It's a scheme to enrich the financial firms that he wants to manage IRA accounts. You know, you turn your money over to a financial firm, and they'll manage an account for you, and they'll extract big fees and high commissions and the rest of it. So, and there's no guarantee you'll get anything. If you go through a bad patch, you may end up losing a lot of money. Well, in this case, he's talking about government bonds, U.S. treasuries. Well, who needs Obama to help us buy government bonds? If anybody wants to buy a government bond, a treasury, a note, a treasury bill, a long-term bond.
Right.
It's simple. You can go online and buy them. You don't need a retirement plan to buy them. The only good wrinkle you could say from his plan is that instead of plunking down, you know, so many hundreds of dollars or whatever to buy a financial instrument, whatever you want to spend, you can start off with a $25 contribution monthly, and you can make future ones, subsequent ones, as little as $5 a month. Well, you know, at that rate, you're going to save nothing.
Right.
If you want to save, then you got to save.
Yeah.
You have to make a commitment to save. It has to be regular. That's what I did in my working lifetime. I considered it a monthly expense, so much to cover monthly expenses and so much to save, and I did it my way, and I didn't need his scheme. But what we really need is to regain employer-provided defined benefits that existed when I first went to work. That's what happened. And I must say, as an aside, Graham, I'll never forget my first day on the job. I worked for B.F. Goodrich once as a marketing analyst. Mm-hmm. And literally my first day in the office, my boss called me into his office and he said, you're doing such a bang-up job, I want to give you a raise. I mean, this literally happened. Well, my first day happened to be the day that it was an annual cost of living increase for everybody in the company, from the lowliest clerk to the president to the CEO. So
right.
I got a raise. I forget how much it was,
right.
but inflation adjusted. So there I was. And, I mean, that stuff doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
And there were pensions, and they're all gone. So instead of getting defined benefits, there are defined contributions. If you want to kick in your own money, then companies can kick in a little of their own at their own discretion. They may kick in none, but we need defined benefits brought back. We need guaranteed pensions. We need them secure and safe. We need Social Security protected. It's being wrecked now. And
yep.
the idea is to privatize it, hand it over to Wall Street, and,
yep.
and let them rip people off by managing the accounts.
Right.
And I say en route to getting rid of Social Security altogether, because Republicans hate it, and they
yep.
want to get rid of it. And Obama is a stealth Republican. Well,
yep.
he's only got 3 years to go. Whether he'll do it in his time remaining, I don't know. But we need Social Security protected. We need it strengthened. And people mistakenly call it an entitlement. It's not an entitlement. It's
yeah.
not welfare.
Yeah.
A contractual obligation. You make contributions through payroll deductions,
yeah.
and
hey,
employers
I know how it
match
works.
Them.
Yeah.
It's just like paying insurance premiums.
Yeah.
If you pay insurance premiums, you don't expect the insurance company to welch on you. You could take them to court and sue them and win.
But yeah.
the government can welch on its obligations. And, you know, the old saying, go fight City Hall. You won't
yeah.
get anywhere. So
yeah.
we need everything strengthened. We don't need another phony program. It's, what Obama should have done was pledging to boost and strengthen and increase the benefits of Social Security. But he wants to wreck it. So that
yeah.
never even came up in his speech.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think your analysis is right. I support it.
Well, one other quick comment on Social Security, Graham. One of the big lies that circulates for a good long time, especially during the Bush years and the Obama years, is that Social Security is going bankrupt. It's doing nothing of the sort.
Right.
The one thing that did happen going back, I believe it started a little bit under Nixon, looting the Social Security, the so-called trust fund,
mm-hmm.
where trillions of dollars are in there. It really began under the Reagan administration because of Alan Greenspan. He was the head of a Reagan Social Security commission to review the system that the big lie claim would go broke by the end of 1984.
Right. Yeah, that's good.
But here it is 30 years later.
Yeah, that's good. No, I appreciate all that. Now, do we have a few more minutes to talk about this more broad issue of deception and war?
Oh, absolutely. Please, let's go.
How long
that.
Do we have, by the way?
Oh, we've got about 8 minutes.
Okay, well, I'll just introduce it then. I'll pose it as a challenge to you. How's that?
Okay.
Not in the sense that it disagrees with anything you're saying, but just because you've done a lot of work on financial stuff and would be able to do a much better job at this than I. So I've got a couple of graphs in front of me, and they're showing U.S. military expenditures since about 1939. Now, it's not a very complicated graph, okay? There's about five hills. Well, not about five. There are five hills where U.S. military spending goes way the hell up. The first is Second World War, okay? And that's obvious. That's the biggest. That's a very steep and very high hill. Then the next one is the Korean War. Next one is the Vietnam War. The next one is the buildup under Ronald Reagan. And the next one is the one that we're still in, the Global War on Terror. And it appears that U.S. military spending has briefly halted, and that could change at any moment, depending on what they do in Syria, Iran, whatever. But in any case, we're sort of at the top of a very big hill right now. Now, I, of course, have spent the last few years studying the fraudulent global war on terror, meaning specifically the founding events, 9/11, the anthrax attacks. I've just written a book on the anthrax attacks, should be out in a few months. And as you and I know, there have been a string of false terrorist attacks since then to keep it going, because every time the effect starts to wear off in the minds of Americans, it's necessary to scare them again. So the hill keeps going up. So I'm very kind of intimately familiar with this latest of the five hills, and I've given talks to, I gave a talk to a bunch of students at the university the other day, and I kind of said, suppose that downward slope after the Cold War, as I said, that happened under the Clinton administration, there's no objective reason why that decline in U.S. military spending shouldn't have continued. There was no objective threat in the U.S. that justified it being high. Suppose the fraudulent 9/11 stuff hadn't happened and the Project for a New American Century people didn't have the effect they did and it kept going down. And you begin looking at the billions and billions and ultimately trillions of dollars that would have been saved there, not to mention lives, but let's just talk about dollars for the moment. And what you do is you picture that graph without that fifth hill and you start thinking, my God, deception has caused so much money, not just misery, but, you know, straight outlay of wealth and resources of everything. And then I began thinking of the Reagan buildup. Well, I mean, I lived through all that, and that was based on baloney, too. There was no new objective threat that justified that buildup. It was propaganda. It was ideology. So I thought, wow, we didn't need, you know, that buildup wasn't necessary either. And then I looked at, you know, the third one, which is Vietnam. And I remembered that that whole conflict was based on the U.S. involvement. I mean, it was based on many lies. I just read the Robert Bly poem, but there were two special ones that came out in my mind. One was the lie about the elections of the 1950s, which we don't have time to get into. And, you know, basically the U.S. backed the canceling of the elections that were supposed to peacefully resolve Vietnam's problems. The U.S. sabotaged those elections, or they supported the sabotage. The second is the phony Gulf of Tonkin incident. So two major deceptions without which that whole hill wouldn't exist. That was an unnecessary war. My God, and then I thought, well, the Korean War, I'm not even going to go into that here, but there was deception there too. Then I get back to this really steep World War II thing, and I say, well, I'm looking at Stinnett's book as we speak, Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. It's a very convincing book. The U.S. got into World War II under fraudulent pretext. Now, let me just pause on that. I know we're almost out of time, so I'll be brief here. I'm not saying the U.S. shouldn't at that moment in history have joined the war against fascism. In some ways, it probably would have been a good idea if they'd joined earlier. But is it really necessary to trick the American people every time you want to start a war or get people into a war? Other nations, some of them were able to get in without that particular set of lies. Why did FDR think he needed to fool the American people, which he clearly did? I mean, I think the evidence is overwhelming. So basically, I'm looking at a graph here with five hills in it, and I'm asking this question. How many trillions of dollars has the U.S. citizenry, and of course people all over the world, because this money is drawn indirectly from all over the world, it's not just created by the U.S., how many trillions of dollars have been spent because of these five cases of systematic deception? Now, there's my question to you, and you would probably be able to work it out much more easily than I could. But what I'm trying to do here is to say that people who study finances and economics and expenditures are one group of people, and people who talk about deception and false flag are a different group of people. But what we need right now is for somebody to look at this who studies both of them and who can tell us how much this has cost the world since 1939. That's my challenge.
So much, Graham. It really is shocking, absolutely shocking. And there is no such thing as a just war, no such thing as a good one.
Yeah.
None of these wars ever should have been fought. As far as World War II, well, Japan was waging war for years before 1939 in Asia. But Hitler could have been stopped much earlier in the 1930s, and nobody did anything to do it. So literally, Hitler could have been stopped from invading Poland in 1939, just about on the day I entered kindergarten. I don't remember the exact date, but it was very close to that day, and of course I was too young to know anything.
And you were much too young to stop them from invading Poland.
Well, indeed, even though I was much older, I certainly couldn't have stopped him. But the idea was to appease him and go along with stuff rather than to try to deter war. So we had that horrible war that was the worst war ever fought. To call it a good war is an outrage to the millions who died.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. But again, here's my challenge. How can we show people in dollars and cents what this continuing cycle – of elite deception has cost. And of course, it would be very interesting to talk about human lives as well. But even just in dollars and cents, there's the question.
Many, many trillions of dollars, Graeme. I have no idea how much has been spent by all participants in these wars. But I would dare say, inflation adjusted just from 1939 to today, tens of trillions of dollars.
Yeah, yeah. And what could have been done with that, eh?
What could have been done? Think of the good that money could have done.
Yeah.
My God, literally have made, created paradise on earth that never existed. Graeme, we are out of time. It was an important hour. I look forward to getting you back. There's so much more we can talk about.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Steve.
Thank you, Graeme.
Bye-bye.
Join us again tomorrow. We'll be back on again same time, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Make it a regular habit.